Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. This is part two of a two-part interview with George Stevens, Jr., who's the editor of Conversations with the Great Movie Makers of Hollywood's Golden Age from the American Film Institute. George Stevens, Jr., let's talk a little about your career. You grew up in Hollywood. Your father was a famous film director.
I was born in the Hollywood Hospital.
As you were growing up, did you see a lot of the Hollywood world? Did he take you to the studio?
Occasionally. I think one reason I've survived rather nicely is that I was not closely involved in Hollywood. My parents kept me a little bit a part of it. But, of course, there were times when I go down to RKO and see him working with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne or some of the luminaries of the day.
What was the set like for a little kid? Was it boring? Was it exciting?
You know, it was modestly interesting. It was, kind of Orson Welles said of that studio when he walked into it to make Citizen Kane at the age of 25, he said it's the best electric train set a boy could ever have.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to get involved in films yourself?
I kind of drifted into it. My father gave me the opportunity to work with him in the first instance here in San Francisco when he made I Remember Mama. And then later, my first job was with my summer before my freshman year in college. I had two jobs. One was to break down Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy, because my father was about to begin the script for A Place in the Sun. And the other was to read the scripts and stories that came from the studio. And I rather suspect that was sort of a make-work job, because the viewpoint of a 17-year-old was not necessarily going to be definitive, although it has become definitive in later years with 17-year-old executives at studios.
Right.
But among the things that came was a small book that I read and I found very interesting. And I went over to my father's bedroom one night, and he was in bed, and I said, this is really a good story. I think you ought to read it. And as was his nature, my father waited a minute, and he said, why don't you tell me the story? So I spent about half an hour walking around my father's bed trying to tell him the story of Shane.
Somewhere along the line, you learned how to read a screenplay.
I learned how to read a screenplay, and someone referred to it as my inheritance, was the time I spent in the editing room at Paramount Pictures with my father on A Place in the Sun and Shane. I learned more just by osmosis of how you make images come together on the screen and tell a story.
Hitchcock storyboarded everything.
Yes.
Yeah. Did your father?
My father didn't storyboard, no. If he was in trouble or if the screenplay wasn't good or quite right, he was awfully good at redoing it and making it work as he went along. But he always preferred to have a carefully crafted screenplay. There was a wonderful moment at the AFI seminars. We started this in 1969, and a lot of the kids were from NYU and Columbia and New York, and it was kind of the up-against-the-wall era of the Vietnam War, and they were very suspicious of Hollywood. And so many of them also had this idea that the real way to make films was improvisation. Let's just let it all hang out. We get the camera. And we were charting a different path, one of more Hitchcock, more George Stevens, more crafting screenplays, and that there's a science to storytelling. And Federico Fellini came to do his seminar and brought the film Satyricon. And he was just idolized by these students. And along the way, he'd come with Anthony Quinn, who had starred in La Strada with him. And one of the students asked the key question. He said, Mr. Fellini, we see your films. They're so imaginative. We assume that so much of that is improvised. How do you improvise on the set? And Federico turned to Tony Quinn. He said, improvisatore? Quinn nodded. And Fellini says, improvisatore? No, no. He says, for me, making a motion picture is as scientific as for you Americans sending a man to the moon. Which was a very definitive moment in the history of AFI.
He also tells the great story about the ending of 8 and a half, which is that it just happened to be, he managed to get everybody back onto the set to do a trailer and realized the trailer was the ending of the movie.
Well, I think, if I understand correctly, I think his point may have been that he knew that the ending wasn't right, so he told the producers that he was going to make a trailer when, in fact, he was making the ending of the movie.
George Stevens, Jr., you worked on these films for your father. Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to spend any time with James Dean?
I did. When we made Giant, I got to know Jimmy quite well, and I was remembering the other day, I was in the Air Force at the time, and I would drop in on the set in Charlottesville, Virginia, or Marfa, Texas, or at Warner Brothers. And one day in the summer of 1955, I remember being at Warner Brothers on the soundstage. Jimmy had finished shooting. He finished his work, and he'd come around just to see people and talk. And he said, "Do you want to see my new car?" And he took me outside, and there was a little car that he was called Little Bastard. And, you know, sound stages have these huge, big, tall buildings and narrow streets. And Jimmy says, "Let's go for a ride." And we got in that little Porsche Spyder and drove through the sound stages, through the streets of Warner Brothers at a, somewhat over the speed limit that Jack Warner had set. And it was only later that I realized that we were riding around in the car that he died in.
He did not finish all of his scenes for the film, or did he?
He did. He'd finished all of his shooting. He had not finished. There was one scene, the scene as the older Jet Rink when he's drunk at the end of the picture of that big banquet. His speech was hard to understand, and so it was necessary to bring someone in to just loop some of the dialogue. But he'd done all the shooting.
After those three films with your father, did you work on Diary of Anne Frank, too?
I did. That was one of the really memorable experiences of my life, because we worked on that one from beginning to end. I was the associate producer, and as he went behind schedule, as he often did, he was unable then to go overseas to shoot all the location footage, and he assigned me to direct the location footage at Anne Frank's place where they hid in Amsterdam. And before we started shooting, my father and I made a journey. We went first to Dachau, the concentration camp near Munich, where he had been the day it was liberated, and he made these incredible photographs, motion picture footage of that concentration camp. And we went from there to Amsterdam, where we went in the morning down to a little office in the city and met Otto Frank, Anna Frank's father, who was the only survivor of all those people in that attic. He survived Auschwitz. And in this little office, he went to a filing cabinet and opened the drawer and took out something wrapped carefully in tissue paper and unfolded it and put in front of us Anne Frank's diary. It was one of the most moving moments I can remember, to see the actual pages on which she wrote that story, which, as Dad pointed out at the time, that for all of the great power of Hitler and his armies, here's a little girl with a pen whose work survives them and their mischief.
How accurate do you think a film needs to be in terms of sets? And I'm thinking specifically of Diary of Anne Frank. You know, it's the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And I would gather that was what the attic looked like.
It was very similar. Otto Frank on that day in Amsterdam took us, and I think it was the first time he'd been back in that building. And we climbed up to the very top of it and looked, and you saw this small space where they had survived for so many months.
Did the set designer go there and take a look, too?
Yes, and we had photographs. And we did not exactly copy it, but it was very much in the spirit of it, in a replica.
The directors don't talk about verisimilitude in that sense in this book, but how important do you think it is to try to make it as accurate as possible? I think one of the directors, I don't remember who at this point, talked about trying to make it real, but only one really talked about it.
The audience doesn't know exactly what something looks like. What you want to do is create an artistic manifestation of it that is believable to the audience.
At that point, this was, 1959, 1960?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that when you were directing for Alfred Hitchcock's TV show?
I was directing Hitchcock, I think, in 1957, 58, in there. Those of your audience who remember those half-hour stories, Hitchcock directed a number of them himself, and he did all of the openings and closing, and so that was great fun.
Did he offer any advice to you as a novice TV director?
Well, I wish I could say that he did, but they kind of put you out there, they throw you in the cold water and let you fend for yourself.
And then after that, in the 60s, this is before the founding of AFI, what were you doing then?
Well, I had a providential meeting. I met Edward R. Murrow.
Is the portrait of Murrow in Good Night and Good Luck similar to the Murrow that you actually knew?
I am so happy to say that it is. David Strathairn does a brilliant job of recreating Murrow's persona.
And the speech that, were you there for the speech that Murrow gave?
No, that was a speech he made when he was leaving CBS before,
which was a little bit earlier,
before President Kennedy had asked him to come and run the United States Information Agency, to which he invited me to come back and run the Motion Picture Division.
When you and he were talking, did he talk at all about the relationship of the press and government?
Not really. Our job was to tell America's story abroad, so it was sort of it was a different page in his life at that time.
But it was a different page also in American government's life, too. That was the Kennedy era.
It was such a remarkable period, and it was such a privilege to be part of that short, shining period of the dedication and enthusiasm that so many young people with positions of responsibility, and a president of such complete curiosity and interest. He was interested in everything, which made people working at all different agencies. I was one of those people. You'd heard stories that President Kennedy wanted to know something about Thailand. He wouldn't call the Secretary of State. He'd call the Asia desk and ask for the Thailand desk officer. So the Thailand desk officer is talking to the president, and it just made everybody around the government think they were appreciated. And I got a few of those calls, and it was a wonderful experience to have worked for President Kennedy.
And then along came Vietnam. Were you still there when Vietnam began to kick in?
I was.
And what was going on in your mind as that began happening and America began protesting?
Well, to put it plainly, I was in the government. We were, in that 1963, providing support for this government so they could maintain their own. You know, I was on board. And then gradually, as you began to see, it enlarged, and like many Americans, my view of it turned.
At which point you left the government?
I had left the government to start the American Film Institute.
Whose idea was that?
Well, the National Endowment for the Arts was created in 65. They knew what to do about dance, give grants to dance companies, give grants to orchestras for music, theater, grants to theater companies. Nobody knew what to do about film. And I had been thinking about and talking about with some people the idea of an American Film Institute. And it fit into that plan, and it was decided to do it, and I was asked to run it.
And the idea of the seminars themselves, that came from you as well? Or?
Well, it did, because the idea of this conservatory, which would not be a great big film school, but be a place, a bridge between the school and the profession, and the idea that there were so many of the great filmmakers still around living right near there that we would institute a kind of tutorial tradition and bring them up there to pass on this knowledge. The fulfillment of that, and it's why I'm so pleased that the great movie makers of the Hollywood's golden age, to have that all in a book, it had not occurred to me at the time how valuable this would be later on and how provident it was that we were tape recording all of these seminars. And what's so interesting about these people, their profession was storytelling. And it turns out, you've read the book, that they are great storytellers, not just on the screen, but they can talk about their own life in interesting ways.
Billy Wilder, there was a biography of Billy Wilder called On Sunset Boulevard, which was, you know, like a doorstop. And then someone else after that came out with a bio, and they said about Wilder that the first book, he was such a raconteur that no one ever knew that anything he said was true.
He also had a capacity when he doing these seminars. It was hysterical. I mean, the Viennese accent helps it, but he was talking about Marilyn Monroe. And then they said, well, how was it working with Marilyn Monroe? He said, well, it was difficult. He said there were more books written about Marilyn Monroe than World War II, and the two are very similar. He said, you know, with Marilyn, he said, you didn't know what time she was going to come to work. You didn't know if she was going to come to work. You didn't know if she was going to know her lines, if she came to work. He said, but it was worth it. He said, I've got an old aunt in Vienna. He said, I could hire her. She would be there at 5 o'clock every morning. She would know all the lines cold. But who wants to look at my old aunt in Vienna?
Did you have much contact with Wilder outside of the context of the AFI?
I used to see Wilder a lot socially. My friend Irving Paul Lazar, Swifty Lazar, used to have dinner parties, and Billy was there. And Billy was always on. He was always telling stories. Just one little thing from a script. He wrote the screenplay for Ninotchka, for Ernst Lubitsch, who was his mentor. And one little Billy Wilder scene. A man walks into a coffee shop. "I'd like a cup of coffee without cream." Waiter says, "We don't have cream. Would you like a cup of coffee without milk?"
You're listening to an interview with George Stevens, Jr., whose book is Conversations with the Great Movie Makers of Hollywood's Golden Age. Billy Wilder did a movie called The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. There are rumors that that was originally a three-hour movie that was destroyed by the studio. Have you ever heard about that?
I've heard a little bit about it, and I don't really know much. I think it's probably exaggerated. I think Billy's too smart to make it into a three-hour movie. Maybe it was 2 hours and 15 minutes, and they wished it were 2 hours. And then there just came a time when nobody would make a picture with Billy Wilder because his pictures, you know, you can have one that doesn't succeed, but if you have two or three, mentioning Irving Paul Lazar, it's a very instructive story about the change in American movie making and movie distribution. There was that time, I guess it was in the 80s, where you started to have computerized reports. Computers came in, so the studio would know on Saturday morning how the movie did on Friday night. That was new. Before, it didn't have that. And I remember getting to Los Angeles one time and calling Lazar, and he said, "Come over for dinner tomorrow night. Billy's going to be there." And I said, how's Billy's movie doing? That opened the week before. He says, "Billy's movie is dead," which means that the studios now knew that it hadn't had a good Friday night, so they pull back advertising and they summarily execute a movie.
Well, what happens then to a director like Terrence Malick, who comes out with two brilliant movies after a long hiatus, and neither of them do well at the box office?
Well, The Thin Red Line did respectably. The New World has not had a good response at all at the box office. I hope he will get another chance. But you are putting your finger on the equation. Will the studios go one more time to make a film with someone whose last films have not been huge successes?
How did you get involved in making The Thin Red Line?
Because of my friendship with Terrence Malick. He had not made a film in 20 years. Terry is a very unique individual. Suddenly, movie making wasn't the most important thing. He moved to Paris. He loved to go bird watching. And suddenly, 20 years went by. During that period, Terry wrote screenplays, often not credited, but that's how he supported himself. And he had written a screenplay for two producers in New York of James Jones's The Thin Red Line. And they had come to Mike Medavoy, a friend and partner of mine, and asked us, they couldn't get it produced, and would we take it on? And it said, Terry won't direct it. We said, well, maybe with us he will direct it, and long story, finally we made it.
What's the story behind the editing in which I think it was one of the actors was virtually cut out of the film?
Terry has a very distinctive, his own approach to filmmaking. The script of The Thin Red Line was maybe 230 pages. It was too long. We all knew it was too long. It was very hard for Terry to cut it. So he ended up shooting Adrian Brody, had what was meant to be a very important role in the film. And by the time the film was completed, Adrian's role was almost gone.
You've been listening to part two of a two-part interview with George Stevens, Jr., whose book is Conversations with the Great Movie Makers of Hollywood's Golden Age from the American Film Institute. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.